Every man a king. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Huey P. Long, United States Senator from Louisiana speaking. I was formerly the governor of that state before becoming the United States Senator. And prior to that time, I was for some 10 or 11 years engaged in the work as the Public Utility Commissioner for the state of Louisiana. And I will speak to you on the economic problems affecting this country at the present day and time. As I have previously stated over the radio, and as I have said in speeches which I have delivered on the floor of the United States Senate, which I hope some of you have had occasion either to hear or to read, our condition in America today grew from a condition by which a few people became possessed of more than they needed, resulting in a large number of our people becoming possessed of what they required upon which to live. I am not going to undertake to say that all who hear should agree with me. I will not quarrel with those who have ideas of government contrary to those which I entertain. But to those of you who believe in the Bible, I may say in advance that I will have no argument whatever in reaching the same conclusion as you reach, if you will consider such facts as I will lay before you. But realizing that there are many who do not accept the Bible as being divine, and that also there are many who have no particular creed or religion, I will discard that and say that those of you who believe in the works and the sayings of the Greek philosophers are those of you who agree with the theory followed by Lincoln and by Jefferson and by Christ, that those of you who believe in the doctrine of the Pilgrim's Fathers, those accepting such teachings will have no occasion to disagree with anything that I say or with what I am undertaking to do in this country today. Now, my friends, I have been one of the two men undertaking to compose a musical rendition. I don't know how you'll like it, but before I proceed further, has been my good fortune many years ago to make the friendship of Mr. Harry Link, who is the president of the world's greatest publishers of music. And I'm going to ask Mr. Link to play and to sing for you the song which I helped to write entitled Every Man a King, before I proceed further. Mr. Link. My friends, in the year 1916, President Woodrow Wilson asked the Congress of the United States to allow him to appoint an industrial relations commission to determine what was the cause of industrial unrest at that time prevailing in America. And the Congress passed such authority for the president, and he appointed an industrial relations committee. And at the conclusion of a number of months' labor, they reported that the chief cause of the trouble existing at that time was that 2% of the people owned 60% of the wealth, and that 65% of the people owned less than 5% of the wealth of the United States. They also said that there was a middle class of about one-third the people who owned about one-third of the wealth. And that middle class, I take it, was what was more or less holding hair and hide together at the time of this report of 1916. But to sum up what that report said way back there nearly 20 years ago under President Wilson, what that report said was that our chief trouble then was that two men owned twice as much as 98 owned, and that the great bulk of our population, two-thirds of all of our people, own less than one-twentieth of the entire wealth of this country. Now, as bad as that condition was, when 1930 rolled around, we found a condition twice that bad. And when 1935 rolled around, we found a condition far worse than it was in 1930. I was in 1929 standing in the lobby of the biggest hotel in the South, the Roosevelt Hotel in New Orleans, Louisiana. And a gentleman who was a president of one of the big banks of this country walked up to me and said to me, Governor, I was at that time the governor. He says, Governor, we've had a terrible stock crash today. Everything has fallen. The bottom has fallen out. And he said, I would advise the state not to undertake to sell any bonds or to float any securities for a week or two until this condition has abated. I said, well, do you mean to tell me that the stock market has had a great crash today? He says, there's never been anything like it in history. I says, then I want to tell you that conditions are not going to abate in any week, nor 2 weeks, nor in any 2 years, nor 4 years, nor 5 years, unless and until there is a redistribution of wealth. What I prophesied about that time was later printed in the newspapers down in the state of Louisiana. Also, Mr. Heck, for it was he to whom I was speaking in 1929, Mr. Heck, I was later told, reported to the board of directors of the Hibernia Bank what I had said that day. Of course, my prophecy was more or less given the general ha-ha, because everybody thought that was something that was just happening by accident and that it would clear up as other things had cleared up in a short period of time. But my friends, back in 1917 and in 1916, I was not prophesying from wisdom when I said and when I wrote and published to the world the statistical data showing that day by day and year by year, the rich were growing richer and the poor were becoming poorer. And I said that the day of economic chaos could not be delayed beyond 15 years and that it would most likely occur within 10 years. That was in 1916. And 1917, and some of those articles were written even as late as the year 1919. And I might say that I continued to point out those conditions and those trends of affairs until as late almost as the day when the final crash came in 1929. So when the World War came on in 1917, it may have been that the conditions of the concentration of wealth was accentuated by the war, or it may have been that the war postponed the final day of reckoning. But be that as it may, everything occurred between the 10 and 15 year period as I had originally anticipated. Now, ladies and gentlemen, after this report of 1916, which was just before we went into the World War, and just before I had begun to make my statements as to what we could expect to happen, after this statement of 1916 by the Industrial Relations Commission, we waited for another report as to what was happening to the ownership of our wealth until the Federal Trade Commission, it was, published its annual report of 1930. And in that report, this agency of our United States government said that, gauged upon what the decedents left, that it appeared that 1% owned 59% of the property in the United States. That meant that in the 14 years which had elapsed between 1916 and 1930, that instead of conditions improving, that whereas 1% owned 59% of the wealth in 1930, it was 2% that owned about 59 or 60% in 1916, 14 years before. So in the 14 years' time from 1916 to 1930, 1% owned what 2% owned in 1916. Also, that middle class that existed in 1916, that was about one-third of our people, that owned about one-third of our wealth, that middle class of one-third fell to one-fourth. It fell to one-fifth. It fell to one-sixth. And today there is not a middle class of 10% of the people in the United States that own 10% of the wealth of this country. They have either been found, that middle class of people, they have either been found to have fallen into the lower strata, or else some isolated few have managed to work themselves up into the class of luxury and multimillionaires. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we waited from 1930 for the government to make another report by which we could be shown from these accredited government statistics as to what was happening to the national wealth. And this year, 1935, a report was made by the concern that guarantees the bank deposits for the government. It is named the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And this report made this year, 1935, said that it had found that 1/150th of the people owned 67% of the wealth, gauged by bank deposits alone. That is, of all the money in the bank, 2/3 of 1/100th part of our people owned 67% of all the money that was in the bank. That was 2/3 of 1% of the bank depositors. That doesn't tell the entire story, because I would estimate that there are half of our people who don't even have a bank account. And so it is twice as bad as the statistics of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation would indicate. Well, there's other things that I might say to indicate to you what we can say is happening to our national wealth as to how much the common people have and to how much the richer class has. If you noted from your public press some weeks back, from the income taxes paid, it was found that there were fewer people of moderate incomes and more people of the millionaire incomes than they were a year ago, indicating the gradual trend of the times, that the masses became possessed of less and the multimillionaire and billionaire class becomes possessed more and more as time goes on. Well, my friends, those of you who may remember me in the days of the Chicago Convention of 1933, when we were nominating a president of the United States, those of you who remember me may recall that I was one of the big four or big five or big six, whatever number they was, accredited with having shaped the course of the Chicago Convention, wherein I was nominated by the Democratic Party, Mr. Franklin D. Roosevelt, for President of the United States. And we ran Mr. Roosevelt for President. Upon what platform? I'll give that to you in just a moment. This is Huey P. Long, United States Senator from Louisiana.
Every man a king, for you can be a millionaire. But there's something belonging to others. There's enough for all people to share. When it's sunny June and December too, or in the winter time or spring, there'll be peace without end. Every neighbor a friend with every man a king.
my friends, continuing my speech, because you have just heard again my friend Harry Link, president of the music publishing house of Donaldson, Douglas, and Gumbel, play one of the particular pieces that I undertook to help compose, entitled Every Man a King. And since you've heard that, which I hope you'll try to remember yourselves, I will continue along the line as to why we were undertaking to nominate and later to elect Mr. Roosevelt, and upon what platform we were basing his candidacy for the presidency of the United States in 1933. We had seen this condition. There had developed in America, under Mr. Hoover, and under Mr. Coolidge and Mr. Harding, and under them all back there, I will not undertake to say how far back we should go, maybe back 50 years, for all I know. But there had developed a condition in which the American people were in need in the land of plenty. People were starving for food, of which this country had an abundance. People were crying for clothes, of which we had too much. Men, women, and children were crying for homes in which to live, notwithstanding the fact that we had too many houses in which the people could at that time been living in comfort. And so Mr. Roosevelt was picked by us as a candidate for President of the United States. And the platform upon which he ran and upon which we based his candidacy was that he promised that we would go out and make our search and locate the trouble affecting the forgotten man. And that instead of there being starvation in the land of plenty, that we would cut down the size of the big men's fortunes and give something to the balance of this people in which, on which to make them comfortable and upon which their children could be educated. So we made the race for Mr. Roosevelt, the President of the United States, on that platform. But he has been elected. This is now the third year of Mr. Roosevelt's depression, and the conditions are today worse than they were at any other time. Now, I don't ask you to take my word for that. I would ask you to accept no information whatever, except such as might be directly accredited by the department serving under and with the approval of Mr. Roosevelt himself. What do we find today? Why, there are today in the United States 1 million more men unemployed today than there were 1 year ago. That's according to the accredited departments that are accepted by the government. We find further that according to the United States government's own statistical data, that there are 5 more million people on the relief rolls, so-called the dole, than there were 1 year ago. And I think I may well tell you that there are another 5 million trying to get on those roads today who are not permitted to place themselves back. Well, what else do we find? We find this. An indebtedness in this country, public and private, that means debts owed by the United States and the states and by the people individually, all of which amount to $252 billion. That means that every man and every woman and every child owe at this time $2,000 apiece. There used to be a time back in the country where I was raised when we heard that a baby had been born, we'd rush to the home of this newborn babe to carry it a present. Some of us would take it a baby rattler, some of us would give it a silver cup, and some might give it a spoon. So that with these meager possessions, a child came into the world. These were possessions which it might treasure as keepsakes in the mature days of life. What do we do today when a baby is born? Do we rush to the home of the parents, shower it with presents? Is that the gift that we still make? Oh, no. That's all been changed. Today, when the baby is born, before it breathes its first breath of life on earth, we tie a $2,000 debt around its neck. And 95% of them struggle through life and are never able to discharge their part of the debt before the time of that death and demise from this earth. Well, my friends, we find this condition prevailing. We find, I am very sorry to say, no hope for the future that there is to be erected under the present system of things according to the lights before the powers that be. Now, my friends, When I went to the Congress of the United States and became a member of the United States Senate in January 1932, I proposed a remedy for this condition. I didn't expect it to pass at that time, though I spoke for it most earnestly. I said at that time, as I had said for many years before, that the depression with which we are to be erected under the present system of things, according to the lights before the powers that be. Now, my friends, when I went to the Congress of the United States and became a member of the United States Senate in January 1932, I proposed a remedy for this condition. I didn't expect it to pass at that time, though I spoke for it most earnestly. I said at that time, as I had said for many years before, that the depression with which we were then afflicted could not be ended by the nostrums and expedients being employed, but that unless we took from the captains of big fortunes part of their swollen wealth and transferred it through the sinews of the government into the hands of the masses, that the abnormal condition with which America was at that time afflicted would not be abated. So I proposed in the United States Senate, in the form of a resolution, that the fortune of all big men be limited to a few millions of dollars to the man. That no man be allowed to inherit in his lifetime from his father or mother, or from his grandfather, grandmother, or anyone else, more than a few million dollars in a lifetime. And that no man be allowed to make more than $1 million in any one year. The purpose of that resolution was that we might pass laws, the effect of which would be that while we might have millionaires and men worth 2 million and men worth 3 million maybe and men worth maybe 5 or 6 million, but that nonetheless there must be a limit on how big any one man could get in order that there could be something left for the balance of the people. I was condemned for offering that resolution, and it received about 6 votes in the Senate that day. We went ahead thereafter and elected Mr. Roosevelt. Then I offered my resolution again, somewhat reformed. It received nearly 20 votes, but it had the opposition of Mr. Roosevelt and the leaders in Congress and of the Roosevelt administration in general, notwithstanding that laws to that effect had been promised by the president when he was a candidate for that office. Of course, we were led to believe that time that later on Mr. Roosevelt was coming along with it. But we waited and we waited and we waited. We waited the first year. He didn't do it. We waited the second year. He didn't do it. And we started into the third year, and we were met by a news dispatch from the United Press in which Mr. Roosevelt was placed upon record as saying that he had set his face against any more taxes upon the big rich for fear that it might interfere with his so-called recovery program that he had in mind for the people of the country. So, ladies and gentlemen, as much as I regret, I must say to you that hope from Mr. Roosevelt's administration appears to be practically extinct. And there is no need that we should wait longer. We must again take up the cudgel. We who are now in the third year of Mr. Roosevelt's depression, we who are in the throes of a worse depression than's ever existed before, we who took up the torch in battle before the American people, that as God has given us the power to produce, that mankind should have the power to share, we who have made that fight must not become discouraged. We must take up the cudgels and the torch again. Fight for a few more years, if that may be necessary, to bring about what we were promised and led to believe we would already be granted by this government. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if I may be permitted to be bold, and I do not consider that it is being bold, I might say to you that we've been fooled by the promises of the Republicans, and we have been fooled by the promises of the Democrats. And while I am a Democrat, and while I am a party man, nonetheless, the welfare of the American people is paramount. We cannot place our head in the halter to follow anybody except what is necessary for the relief and deliverance of humanity in general. Why should we here be struggling in this condition today with more unemployment than we've ever had? And is the unemployment only as bad as we have been told it is? Is it only 1 million more people who are out of work today than there were 1 year ago? I say to you that there are a great deal more people out of work than 1 million, over and above what number were out of work last year. Why? Because the statistics upon which we say, or rather upon which they calculate, that there are 1 million more men unemployed today than there were a year ago, are more or less industrial statistics. And they do not take into account the fact that there are thousands and hundreds of thousands and maybe millions of people who are becoming 21 years of age. They put them among those who are unemployed. They say that they never did have any job or position to work, and therefore that since they have become 21 years old and never have worked before, not having been employed before, that they cannot be employed now, and therefore that they cannot be called unemployed. So they therefore wipe out a few million that they don't count there. Then, in the agricultural regions of this country, formerly every man was allowed to farm and raise what he desired. He sold it on the market for what it would bring. The market got so bad that they decided that they had to restrict the amount that one man could reap from the harvest of a crop, or rather from what he was allowed to plant even. And so they said to the man who had previously raised 10 million bales of cotton, we can only let you raise 2 bales of cotton. And they said to the man who had formerly raised so much wheat, we can only let you raise half that much wheat. And as a result of it, maybe there were 5 farmhands raising 10 bales of cotton. They had employment, but maybe only 1 farmhand. Or if they gave the 5 farmhands employment, they had work for the 5 to do only 1/5 of the time. So that if you would properly survey and properly accredit the idleness that has been occasioned in the agricultural part of our life, I venture the assertion that instead of our now having 1 million more men unemployed than we had 1 year ago, that we would have from 6 to 8 million more people unemployed today than we had 1 year ago. Therefore, our condition from every sign, from every guide, and from every single, our condition in this third year of the Roosevelt administration brings to us a condition unabated, accentuated, and worse than it has ever been. Too much to eat, too much to wear, and too much for the people to have. And yet, they're starving while we have too much to eat. They're naked while we have too much to wear. They're homeless while we have too many houses for them to live in. And those of us who have pursued that phantom, when every man might be a king, the abundance of God's blessing might be shared, find ourselves today encroached upon to the extent really worse than it was ever before. Whereas we have shared that hope and that dream had come, every man would be a king.
Every man a king, every man a king, for you can be a millionaire. But there's something belonging to others, there's enough for all people to share. When it's sunny June, or December too, or in the winter time of spring, there'll be peace without end, every neighbor a friend, when every man's a king. But there's something belonging to others, there's enough for all people to share. When it's sunny June or December too, or in the winter time or spring, there'll be peace without end, every neighbor and friend, when every man's a king.
Now, my friends, this is Joey P. Long speaking. United States Senator from Louisiana. If I may continue now. We have undertaken, as I have previously stated to you, not to keep this country from having its men who are well-to-do, not to prevent this country from having those worth $1 million, or $2 million, or $3 million, but we have undertaken to share the wealth of this country, to share the fruits of mankind, the blessings of the Almighty, in such a way that there will be a spreading of what must be had to sustain life, and that above that, we have no objections to men becoming so big as they may desire, except that they must not possess so much that they cannot use it themselves, but thereby create pestilence and destitution among the masses at the bottom, who need those things which the wealthy possess, and which the wealthy have no place in which to put them, and no use for them at all. Now I have proposed, my friends, and I will again propose in the coming days of this present Congress, that we proceed along the lines that the American people were promised, that we proceed to a spreading of the wealth, that we share our wealth, that we redistribute the profits of this land in such a way as will give everybody a home, the comforts of a home, employment, and a living, in such a way as will give education, pensions to those who are aged, and as will generally care for our economic problems. I do not propose that we will forbid millionaires. On the contrary, what I have proposed and what I have advocated and will advocate would mean that we would have many more millionaires than we now have, because we would make it so much more possible for people to earn enough to fall into the millionaire class. But we would prohibit multimillionaires, and we would prohibit the billionaire. What is that program? It is this. We propose an annual tax upon fortune, upon big fortunes. We will not put any tax at all on the first $1 million which one may own. But all over $1 million that a man owns, the second million we'll tax that 1%. The third million we'll tax 2%. The fourth million we'll tax 4%. The fifth million we'll tax 8%. The sixth million we'll tax 16%. The seventh million will tax 32%. The eighth million will tax 64%, and after that we'll tax it 100%. The practical effects of that tax would be that when it was levied annually, that it would not be difficult at all for men to own $1 million or $2 million or $3 million. Maybe it would not be difficult for one to own up to $4 million. But beyond that point, it would be extremely difficult for one to own any more money. In other words, it would mean millionaires limited somewhere below the $4 million or the $5 million mark. Now, I think that's too much. I think $4 or $5 million is too much for one man to own. But we can allow that much to one man and have left enough that if properly spread among the masses, there will be enough for all to share and to have a comfortable living and the conveniences and most of the luxuries of this life. That isn't the entire program. There is the following. We will propose in this resolution, which I have introduced, and which I will introduce again, somewhat modified, that no one will be allowed to inherit more than $1 million in a lifetime. And no one man will be allowed to have an income of more than $1 million a year. Added to that, we'll have to share the work. We'll limit the hours of toil to 30 hours to the week, maybe less, to 11 months of work per year, maybe less. We limit the hours of work and the number of months of work to such an extent that instead of having half the people working too much and half the people unemployed and idle and starving and naked, that all will perform the work that is necessary to give whatever can be consumed and used by the entire population of this country. So we will share the wealth, and we will share the work. We will provide from the money that is thrown into the United States Treasury after we've given employment to the people. We will provide from the money that's thrown into the treasury of this United States government from these big fortunes home and the comforts of home, including such things as radios and automobiles, for every family, for every man, woman, and child who are good enough not to be in jail in the entire length and breadth of these United States. We will provide, ladies and gentlemen, for the education of the youth of this land from this money that the government will have. We will not have children born with a right to be educated if their parents have the money to send them to college. But we will limit the education of a child only by the mental capacity to absorb. It will be the problem of the government that all are entitled to be educated from what the government receives, from trimming down the surplus fortunes and swollen earnings of the limited few who now oppress the balance of our people. Along with that, my friends, we have the old age pension. Those who reach the age of 60 would be given a pension, a sufficient amount of money that they might be comfortable from the day when they were 60. And they will thus be retired from the active avenues of earning and employment, and thereby make room for the young men who are coming up to have something to do upon which they can earn a living. Then, my friends, we will have a farm relief provision. We'll not say to a man that you can't plow all this land, or that you can't earn more than so much, or that you can't raise more than so many bales of cotton, or so many bushels of wheat, or so much corn. But we will let every man plant anything he wants and gather all that he can. There will come the time, however, when in some years there will be more cotton produced than we can use, or than we can sell abroad. There will be more corn produced than we can use. But we will erect in every county in the United States warehouses, cold storage, and heating storage plants. And whatever there is produced, cotton, corn, or even the perishable products, will be stored and preserved until we have accumulated enough that there is more than a 12-month stock on hand of any one particular crop. And then we'll say to the farmers and planters who are raising that particular crop, be it cotton or corn or something else, we have enough of this for 12 months, so we're not going to have any of it raised at all during the next 12 months. We have a surplus stored sufficient to care for 12 months, and we will not want an oversupply. Then that farmer will say, then what am I going to do next year if you don't let me raise the crop that I raised last year? We'll say to him, we've provided for that. We're going to have public works in this particular territory on which you're going to be employed next year. And then we'll begin in that particular area or near that particular area the kind of work upon which these people can be employed. It may be doubling the width of the road. It may be doing away with overhead crossing. It may be impounding the floodwaters. It may be canalizing the rivers and the streams and the bayous. It may be providing us with better lakes. It may be any number of those things which would expand our intrinsic wealth and resources and provide greater comfort to our people. And whenever the time might arrive that we didn't have work enough for them to do, then we'd have something else most surely that they could do. We could do what we did down in Louisiana, the great state of Louisiana, of which I was governor. We could say to them, those of you who were not educated when you were boys and girls, we're going to open up schools here this year and let you go to school and learn what you didn't have a chance to learn when you were a boy or when you were a girl. In other words, my friends, our entire program means this: none too big, none too small, none idle, none overworked. The work shared, the wealth shared, education, employment, always a supply of goods and things on hand for an emergency or a famine, which maybe we do or do not anticipate. Every man a king, every man sharing in the splendor and abundance of God's earth. None deprived of the fruits of the labor which he has justly rendered to a country. None looking toward the day of mature age and life, feeling that they'll be out of employment and unable to receive or earn a sustenance, but everyone knowing that as he stood in the shadows of God's eternal blessing, that if he has contributed and is willing to contribute his share of the work and the labor, that this country will not only provide for others, but will provide for him as well. Now, my friends, it will take the united effort of us people to accomplish these good results. We need the work. We need the contacts.
and the cooperated efforts of one with the other. I have included in my program the payment of the bonus to the soldiers. I offered that amendment in the United States Senate during the last session of Congress. I will offer it again, because we ought never to have delayed paying the debt that we owed to the soldiers of the World War half as long as we have. It ought to have long since been paid, not only to help them as a matter of simple justice, but because the circulation of that money has been badly needed ever since the beginning of this period of depression. And now in this third year of this Roosevelt depression, if the people of America will immediately organize themselves everywhere, not from any particular central source, but in every community, if the people will get together, meet together, talk together, study together, and organize what we call a share our wealth society, and get to work in order that they can contact their neighbor and bring them into this movement, the purpose of which is to limit the size of the big man's fortune, to guarantee home and comfort and employment and reasonable income to all of the masses, education to the children, pensions of the aged, farm relief that will be practical. If our people will get together on this program, organized into Share Our Wealth Society, then this concerted action will deliver and free the American people most surely and most effectively. I hope that we all may join in what has been commanded by the Lord, in what all prophets have found to be necessary, and that in this land of abundance we may share the product produced for the labor of mankind and showered upon us through the blessings of the Lord. Now, my friends, I'm going to conclude by letting my friend Mr. Harry Link sing to you again the song, Every Man a King.
Every man a king, every man a king, for you can be a millionaire. But there's something belonging to others. There's enough for all people to share. When it's done,